Welcome to Brain and Avat. We are delighted to be rejoined by David Benatar, one of our favorite guests, and we're going to be talking about, I think, the issue of the moment. We're going to be talking about the Israel-Palestine conflict, and we're going to be trying to understand it with some philosophical principles and some historical analysis. David, would you like to start with a thought experiment?
Yes, certainly. You've just mentioned historical, but because this is a thought experiment, I'm going to be somewhat ahistorical and give you an account of a history that didn't take place. So sub-Saharan Africa was once a continent populated by dark people. They weren't the first human inhabitants of the continent. They were preceded by Neanderthals, to whose demise it must be said they had contributed. But unjust though that species side was, it had occurred millennia before the lighter-skinned Arabs and even paler-skinned Europeans arrived. The black Africans resisted the invaders, but they were no match for the superior forces. The conquerors put many blacks to the sword and forcibly relocated many others to Europe, North Africa, and the Arabian Peninsula. A small remnant was left in the Eastern Cape of South Africa. The fate of the exiles was on the whole worse. They were enslaved. They were second-class inhabitants of the countries in which they found themselves. Sometimes the conditions were relatively hospitable, but there were periodic massacres and other persecutions. There were forced expulsions and resultant migrations. And they continued to remember their ancestral home in Southern Africa. While the numbers of lighter-skinned people grew, the numbers of black people remained small. And this was in part due to various forces related to discrimination. The blacks preserved distinctive African religion and cultural practices. And with the emergence of nationalism in the 19th century, it was unsurprising that these black people began to think about the resurgence of a national home back in Africa. And some pioneers moved back to Africa in greater numbers. But blacks remained a minority in the place of return in the Eastern Cape. The descendants of the Arab and European settlers were now native, and they were collectively known as the Blancos because of their lighter skin. And the dream of a black state came closer to fruition when there was a recognition of the need for such a state. Britain was granted a mandate over Southern Africa, including Rhodesia, Southwest Africa, and South Africa. And the British had a commitment to establishing a national home for blacks in Southern Africa. A few years later, Rhodesia and Southwest Africa were granted independence, and now the black nationalists were hoping that they could have a home of their own. The non-black majority, the Blancos in South Africa, became increasingly agitated about the prospect of a black national home created in their midst. Now, I could go on and I could tell you the rest of the story, but I think you realize the direction in which it's going, and so I'll just leave the thought experiment there for now.
Interesting. So just to be clear, this is a thought experiment. This doesn't accurately represent the demographics in South Africa or Southern Africa.
Or the world.
Yes. So I'm assuming, though, that you want to parallel the story to the story of Jews being removed from and then wanting to return to Israel? Or is it a parallel between the Palestinians or the Arabs that were removed from Israel and want to return?
I'm just wondering where sympathies among progressives would be for these respective parties if history had gone the way I imagine in the thought experiment.
I see. So basically the idea is that because the people who were removed were people of color, and it's because it's people of color who want to return, that you think progressives would have greater sympathy than they do for Jewish people who want to return to Palestine or want to return to what is today called Israel. So I'm assuming that's the comparison.
I wonder.
You mentioned something else in the thought experiment, which is that in the 19th century, there was a general yearning for nationhood. I think we sort of assume that all countries, the way they look, have always been that way. But that's not the case. That you had unification movements in Europe. You had Garibaldi creating in Italy. You had a similar thing in Germany. That you had different groupings who yearned for a nation. And that Jews were one of those groups. Jews had yearned for a nation for a long time after having been expelled from Israel. And the question is, I suppose, on what basis we think that groups are entitled to some kind of state?
Well, I think you're correct that nations were formed and nations also dissolved to some extent. There have also been divisions of nations into separate nations. That has certainly occurred. I would say one difference between some of these national movements and the Jewish national movement is that it did involve people returning to a land in which only a small proportion of them had been living for millennia. And I think that many opponents of Israel would want to focus on that. So that is a difference. It's just not clear to me that it would undermine a claim for some kind of a homeland. And if you are going to have a homeland, that seems to be the most obvious place where it would be. Now, I want to hasten to add that, of course, can't be at the expense of the local people, or at least not at the total expense of the local people. Because as my thought experiment suggested, people who have been living in a particular place for a millennia, I would even say a generation, have a certain claim on the land where they are, and to be able to continue to live there in ways that they're not discriminated against and they treated as equals. But that is sort of theoretically consistent with a Jewish homeland in somewhere in the land of Israel. And in fact, we have that within the boundaries of the pre-1967 Israel, where you do have a 20% Arab minority, and those are equal citizens of the state.
For a bit of further historical context, I mean, you have this yearning for a state in the 1890s when the Zionist movement starts, and then you have Jews that have always lived in that region. And then over time, you have Jews sort of joining the region, and then you eventually have the formation of the State of Israel in 1948 after, you know, various other plans had been put in place for such a state to be made. And also what you have in that Israeli Declaration of Independence is a recognition that that State of Israel will be a state which recognizes people of all religions, and specifically calls on the Arab inhabitants to form part of that state. It doesn't call for their expulsion. But once you have the State of Israel being proclaimed, you have hostilities from all of the neighboring Arab states who then invade and warn the Arabs who are living in that newly formed state that they should leave. And so many of them do leave. Also, over the next few years, what you have is that Jews who live in North Africa and in places like Iraq and Yemen, in their hundreds of thousands, are driven out. So much so that almost no Jews live in those parts of the world now, but they are given a home in Israel. You did not find that happened with the Arabs that were living in Israel, that they weren't welcomed in to the neighboring Arab states. Do you have a sense of why there was different approaches?
This should address a background concern that I have to the point you've made. I agree about the facts that you've described there. But what I'm a bit concerned about is I don't want to go down a line where we're presenting facts that are only conducive to the sort of pro-Israel story. It's not that I think that what you've presented is false. It's that the nature of the conflict that evolved in Mandate Palestine leading up to the establishment of the state was a very complex one. There were obviously concerns on the part of Arabs about the influx of Jews. I should say, by the way, that there were instances of migrations of Jews towards Israel over the centuries. They were relatively small numbers, but from about 1840 to 1880, there were significantly more. And they were, by the way, not motivated by Zionist reasons. They were motivated simply by religious reasons to go to what they took to be the Holy Land. But you can understand the local population now gets anxious about this. Even during the Ottoman era, there were some restrictions put on Jewish migration into Israel. And there was a series of events which led to increased hostility between the parties. And I don't want to claim that any one side in this battle was blameless. I mean, that's too simplistic a picture of what happened. And in fact, one of my concerns about this is that each side often tries to demonize the other side. Now, we're seeing a lot of demonization of Israel when you see complaints about it being a settler apartheid state and the colonial enterprise. And this is just total demonization. And when you look at the kinds of protests that take place here and the kinds of things that are said about Israel, the kind of public action this gets, which is completely absent when you think about other kinds of conflicts, many of which don't even make it into the news. We have a serious demonization of a state that occupies a sliver of land for a people that has been long persecuted. And I do want to speak against that narrative because I know how dangerous it is. But I don't want to do so in a way that minimizes the suffering that Palestinians have felt and the anxieties that they felt. And so I want to keep that in mind as well. I want to have a balanced and a fair view, which I think is often not done in the public square.
So one of the arguments used, one of the ways of framing the situation, which I'm guessing your thought experiment is meant to start to dismantle, is the idea that Israel is occupying Gaza, as well as the idea that Israel are colonizers. So they're no better than the British who arrived in Africa, took over and expelled or oppressed the local people. What is wrong with that narrative?
We often hear about the occupation. And in fact, the recent attack on Israel on the 7th of October was attributed to, and in some minds justified by, the purported occupation. Now, the problem with the term occupation is that it means, and it can mean, different things. So sometimes people take it to mean the occupation by Israel of the West Bank, and at least until 2005, from 1967, the occupation of Gaza too. And so sometimes the suggestion is, well, if Israel would just withdraw from those territories, enable the creation of a Palestinian state in those areas, then the conflict would be over. Now, it's not obvious that's true. And one important reason why that's not obviously true is because when other people speak about the occupation, they don't mean the pre-1967 war borders. They mean the entire state of Israel. They want from the river to the sea to be a Palestinian state. And that can mean different things, but they take the foundation of Israel, the very foundation of Israel, to be occupation of Palestinian lands. And I do find this narrative worrying. I understand why it's made, because you had prior to the Zionist movement, a relatively small Jewish population in Palestine, a much larger Arab population. And so the suggestion is that these are foreigners coming in. But I think this is unfair for a few reasons. First of all, there was a longstanding Jewish community in Israel, obviously from the year 70 of the Common Era when the Second Jewish Commonwealth was destroyed. Before that, it was Judea and it was a Jewish state. But with the expulsion by the Romans, you left with a very small residual Jewish community. And for various reasons, it didn't grow. The actual population of the land of Israel, the demographics did change over time. If you think about the relative Christian and Islamic conquests of the land, the nature of the population altered over time. And if you've now got a migration of an indigenous people back to the land that they occupied before, to which they've been devoted, to which they've prayed, and where they really need refuge from worldwide persecution, this does not look analogous to me to the colonial enterprise where you've got a foreign power that conquers a place, sends in its local population, and extracts resources to return to the metropole. This is not your classical colonial story, and I don't think, in fact, it's a colonial story at all. It's a migratory trend with the Zionist ambition tacked on the end. And some people want to say, well, yes, how dare you establish a Jewish state? But we're talking about an area of land which had been part of the Ottoman Empire most recently. Following the defeat of the Ottomans, it fell under a British mandate, and states were being created. Syria was created, Transjordan was created, in due course, the state of Israel was created. And so states were being created out of this land. And it's not at all obvious to me that Jews had no claim on creating a state within some area there, on the understanding that whatever minority would be within that area would be granted equal rights. But I think that idea was intolerable it was obviously by definition intolerable to people who were opposed to the establishment of a Jewish state there.
You raise an important distinction, which is that the usual colonial enterprise is to go to a place to extract resources. If you think about what Israel looks like in 1948, it's basically desert and swampland. There's no oil in Israel. There's really nothing of value in Israel, barring the Israeli people who go in and make the desert bloom. Obviously, there are things that are of value on a cultural level and a religious level. And it's a place that's valuable for people all around the world. The Baha'i gardens are there. You know, there's many of the great faiths have historical places there. But in terms of being a lucrative place, it's not that. I wonder about why there is such a outright condemnation of Israel from progressives. And it seems that part of it is to use these propagandistic terms like colonialist or apartheid. I think it's a word that resonates with a lot of Black South Africans to say, well, apartheid was, you know, a crime against humanity. If Israel's doing that, then they must be criminals. How would you contrast the system of apartheid and what occurs in Israel?
We do need to draw a distinction between what goes on within the 1967 borders and what goes on in the West Bank. I'll speak specifically about Gaza later. I mean, within the 67 borders of Israel, Arabs are equal citizens. Now, is there a sense in which they are worse off than Jews by being in a minority? Yes. I mean, the national anthem is a Jewish anthem, and the flag has got the Star of David on it. It's a Jewish flag. But that's not an experience which is unfamiliar to minorities everywhere. Many of us who are minorities in another country have a distinct sense of being minorities and of the operations of the state and the public holidays and whatever other features there might be of the majority not reflecting our own views. So those are things that minorities have to deal with, but they have equal rights under the law. They can vote just as everybody else can. They can be elected to office. They often are. And so I think that application of the term apartheid there is completely inappropriate. Now, things are more complex in the West Bank because what you have are Israeli citizens living within the West Bank, and they are subject to Israeli law. But the Palestinians living in the adjacent areas within the West Bank are subjected to military law. They don't have all the equal entitlements that Israeli citizens have because they're not Israeli citizens. There, people want to draw the analogy. Even there, it's not clear to me that we're talking about apartheid. I mean, apartheid depends how precisely you want to define it and how narrowly you want to define it. But I think a lot of the baggage that goes with apartheid can't be carried over into this area. For example, apartheid was premised on ideas of racial separation and of racial superiority. And I don't think that that's the best way to interpret what's going on in the separation in the West Bank. What you have are non-citizens who, if they want to get, let's say, access into Israel, have to pass some kind of a checkpoint. Well, if I go into the US, I've got to pass a checkpoint and I've got to meet certain requirements. I agree that I'm treated with much more dignity than Palestinians often are at those checkpoints. And I think this is one of the areas in which Israel could do a lot better than it does. But the very idea that as a non-citizen, you have equal rights to citizens in a country, that's not true anywhere else. Of course, there's the complexity here of the occupation. And I think the long-term solution would in principle be to have two states. But as I've said before, it takes two to reach this peace deal. And I'm not saying that all the fault lies with the Palestinians, although I do think more of it does. But I do think that it takes two to reach an agreement. And these sort of simplistic public notions that Israel is entirely to blame are completely ignorant or malicious, because the suggestion seems to be that if Israel just withdrew, the problem would be solved. But if Israel withdrew from the West Bank as it withdrew from Gaza, there's no prospect that they'd have peace as a result, because even if many Palestinians would accept that, many others wouldn't. And they would continue to wage the kinds of attacks that Hamas has when it had the control over Gaza that it acquired following the Israeli withdrawal. So to simplistically put this at the door of Israel and say, well, if only you'd withdraw, the problem would be solved. That's naive, unless by withdraw you mean suicide.
So just to clarify, David, you mentioned the word occupation. So my understanding of your position is that you agree that Israel occupies the West Bank, but you disagree that that Israel occupies Gaza, but you agree that Israel controls those borders around Gaza, so, or at least many of the borders. And given that border control, progressives argue that's as good as an occupation, and it definitely hinders the country's development when goods can't flow in and out freely. Isn't it basically occupation in another way, another term?
Right. Well, you've made two points, and it looks like the main one is the Gaza one, and I want to come to that in a moment. But let me just say that one complicating feature of the occupation of the West Bank is that this is not a case where one country has gone and invaded another country and conquered it. It's not entirely in that model. Because if you think about between 48 and 67, Jews had to leave, who were living in the West Bank, had to leave following the fall of those areas to Arab forces. So it's not that Jews were not living in those areas before, and it's not that it was an independent country that was now invaded by an aggressor. This was territory that was conquered in a effectively defensive war. There was a preemptive strike, but it was, by all accounts, a defensive war. And then you had Jewish populations moving back in, obviously in much greater numbers than before. And I have all kinds of concerns about the levels of settlements, and we can talk about that as well. But I just want to note that the kind of occupation we're talking about there has much more complexity than Germany invading Southwest Africa and conquering that land and subjecting the local population. It's not the same kind of phenomenon. Now, what about Gaza? Well, yes, Gaza was occupied in the same sense until 2005, but then the Israeli forces withdrew, and with great trauma, they also withdrew the Jewish settlers who had settled in that area following the 1967 war. There was a lot of difficulty in extracting them, but they did extract them. There has been a blockade since 2007 with the Hamas regime taking power and wanting to use this as a launching pad for attacks on Israel. But I think we need to draw a distinction between occupation, where the forces are actually on the ground and there is a settler population on the ground. That, to me, is an occupation, versus where you've withdrawn entirely, allowed people to create their own state, if only they would, and then blockaded it because they pose a threat to you. If you don't draw a distinction between blockade and occupation, then there should be no further complaint if Israel were to go in now and reoccupy and run that administrative territory. It'd be sort of nothing with us, but you could say it's a matter of degree, that it's a greater occupation versus a less occupation. But that I don't think is the best way to define the term occupation. To occupy is to be in the area, controlling it, having your own population come and live there as well. And that's not what's been going on since 2005.
So you hinted at the idea of a two-state solution. Now, I think not everybody knows what the map of Israel actually looks like. First of all, it's a tiny, tiny place. But Gaza and the West Bank are separated by Israeli territory, and they're run by different regimes. So Hamas running Gaza and the Palestinian Authority running the West Bank. And they don't like each other very much. So it seems that the idea of a two-state solution is a difficult one to have. It may be that after the current incursion, if Hamas are eradicated from Gaza, that then you could have the Palestinian Authority running Gaza, and then maybe you do have a cohesive state of sorts. So it seems like there are two other solutions on the table. The one is a three-state solution, where you have, you know, the Independent Republic of Gaza and the Independent Republic of the West Bank. And the other one is a one-state solution, where everybody lives under one border. What are your thoughts on those different scenarios?
Well, it remains to be seen what happens with this war. I'm not optimistic that even if Hamas is routed, that the Palestinian Authority could not take over. They would be seen, I think, as agents of Israel. That would undermine their credibility further. So I really don't see how even an Israeli success in this war is going to enable the Palestinian Authority to take root there. There are scenarios that are being presented. I mean, they suggested a thorough demilitarization of Gaza with independent powers overseeing the ensurance of peace there, and perhaps in time something could be built up. But then you're moving more towards the the two-state solution. So that is possible, but it would take a very long time, I think, for the Palestinians to be able to get their own internal story sorted out and for the Israelis to come to grips with this. Because again, there's a lot of resistance in the current government to a two-state solution. The current Israeli government has parties to it that are intolerant of the idea of two states. Of course, the situation in Israel has moved steadily towards that extreme over the years, I think in part as a result of a complete demoralization about the prospects of a two-state solution. But maybe in time, if things were to improve, if they were to be perceived to be less of a threat, that the political situation in Israel would change and there'd be more receptivity again there to the idea of a two-state solution. But until pretty recently, there was great receptivity within Israel to that. So I think both parties would need to undergo changes which would enable that possibility. The one-state solution, I think many people have settled on because they just see the two-state solution or the three-state solution as failing. I believe this is a kind of naive optimism that people sitting in comfortable conditions in Cambridge, Massachusetts may be able to offer. But this is to deny very real threats to people living within Israel. One of the points is, if you're going to share a polity with people who have the viewpoint of Hamas, which is not only deeply anti-Semitic and openly anti-Semitic, but which is Islamist in its orientation, that wants to establish Sharia law within the territory, and is a repressive, autocratic regime, and not just illiberal, but anti-liberal regime, that persecutes homosexuals, that oppresses women. This is not a state in which Jews are going to be safe, and a lot of other people won't be safe either. And to suggest that this is what the solution is naive. And what I often want to know is, what country in the region do you think that this united Palestine would be like? Would it be like Jordan? Would it be like Lebanon? Would it be like Syria? Would it be like Egypt? Would it be like Iran? Would it be like Saudi Arabia or Yemen? And I could go on and on and on and on as we sort of fan out. There is no state in the area that would make it safe for Jews to inhabit and for a range of other people. And so it's very naive, I think, to suggest that this is the solution.
One of the fallback positions, it's not the only fallback position, but one of the fallback positions is to distinguish between the local Palestinians who are trying to get on with their lives and go to work and get on with their day, and Hamas fighters or Hamas terrorists who are trying to destroy the state of Israel and trying to destroy and kill as many Jews as possible. So the distinction made is, yes, Hamas is an awful entity, but Palestinians are not. And by Israel blockading Palestine or blockading Gaza from the rest of Israel, what they're doing is they're oppressing local Palestinians who have no dog in this fight, who are not blameworthy. What's the way of distinguishing between those two groups in a way that allows for an ethical war to take place and an ethical blockade to take place?
Let's put the war aside for now, because I think the war is separate from the blockade. I have no doubt that there are Palestinians within the Gaza Strip who would like to live in peace with Israel. Of course, we don't hear much from them because they live in a regime where if they would express that view, they wouldn't last very long. So it's very hard to get actual empirical data as to what proportion of the Gazan population supports Hamas and what proportion doesn't. They were elected by a very comfortable majority when they were elected, but they had that election once, and it was a long time ago, in 2007, as I recall. They haven't had an opportunity to express, the population hasn't had the opportunity to express their views again. There's that very real worry there. And where people talk for Palestine to be free, I'm often struck by how they're not concerned about the freedom from their own regimes, the freedom from the corruption and authoritarian nature of the Palestinian Authority, and even worse, the oppression of Hamas. They're only concerned about the freedom from Israel, which suggests to me that the consent of the Palestinians might not be as full-hearted as it purports to be. We don't know what the level of support that Hamas has among its population. But the question is to what extent the Israeli government needs to worry about that when supplies being brought into Gaza are being used to arm the militants in order to launch attacks on Israel. The Israeli government's responsibility is to defend Israel and its citizens. It's only secondarily to worry about the Palestinians. It's not that it must have no regard for them, but the U.S. isn't primarily worried about the interests of South Africans. That's the job of the South African government to do. And the South African government doesn't do that properly. We can't put all the blame on some other country for not intervening and solving that problem. So I think to the extent that there is a very real fear that the absence of a blockade leads to the unrestricted importation of materials to be used to attack Israel and Israelis in the way in which we saw on the 7th of October and for the decades before, the blockade is justified. Now, are there nuances in how it could be done? Very well, possibly. I don't know the details, but none of the people marching in the public square know those details either. That is a matter for detailed analysis. Are they being too restrictive? Is there a way of keeping out more of the weapons while allowing in other things that are needed? These are detailed questions you can ask. I don't know the answers to those.
What is the likely outcome if Hamas laid down their arms, stopped firing rockets at Israel? What would occur? What would that place look like?
Well, this is again a point I've made often before, that I think if Hamas were to cease hostility, and even more if they'd not begun the hostility when they took power in 2007, I think you could have had a nascent Palestinian state there. They could have begun to build up a state, a thriving state, where its citizens were prospering and doing much better. Then any argument for a blockade would be removed. And I don't see that the Israelis would arbitrarily impose a blockade. If they saw that this was a neighbor who was developing peaceably, that would be in everybody's interests. It's not just in the interest of the Palestinians or the Palestinian state. It's in the interest of Israel too. They have prosperous, thriving, who are not discontented and angry. And so I think that would have had massive benefits, and it could still have massive benefits for the Palestinian population in Gaza. And I think it would also provide greater faith that an Israeli withdrawal from all or part of the West Bank, perhaps with some land swap, would lead to another peaceful neighbor, and then would strengthen and embolden the chances for a two-state solution. So that is what would likely happen. Of course, if Israel were to lay down arms, we know what the likely outcome of that would be, and it would not be a two-state solution. It would be a massacre.
The progressive argument seems to ignore that. So it ignores that there is any anti-Israeli sentiment among the Palestinian cause or the Gazan cause. So the view is that the Gazans are an oppressed people. They've been oppressed for so long that they've acted out of desperation. And there's only two options that they have. So one of our prior guests on the show, Raja Halwani, has written to defend this view. He's written criticizing your position on this and defended the view that the Gazans are an oppressed people who only have two options. The one option is to die, and the other option is to attack Israel in order to secure some sort of freedom. Those are its only options. And so they take the view, or Raja takes the view, that if Hamas were to lay down its arms, then it's just a slow death for the Gazans. That would be the future of Gaza. One of the interesting parallels that has been raised by the Israelis, the Israeli officials, is they said, by now, Gaza had an opportunity to become a Singapore or a Hong Kong, to surrounded by states that were in some ways anathema to it, but able to develop prosperously. They had the time and they had the donations to do that, but they've chosen a very different path. And it seems like Raja's position sort of ignores that. It ignores the idea that there is this third option. There's not just die in poverty and squalor and oppression versus attack. There is this possibility of developing your economy and growing your own state.
I agree with you. I think the Palestinians are oppressed. They're oppressed in the first instance by their own leaders and their own authorities. And that leads to further oppression from Israel. The situation of Palestinians has got a lot worse over the years. But this has typically been in response to attacks on Israel. The attacks on Israel have not made the Palestinian situation better. The wall went up, the wall dividing the West Bank from Israel went up in response to a spate of suicide bombings and other killings in Israel proper. The blockade went up in response to Hamas coming to power and using their position inappropriately to threaten Israel. Now the war that is going on and the bombing and the attack on Gaza is a result of this horrendous attack that took place in Israel. All this could be different if the hostilities ended. Don't think that the situation would be anything like as bad if Hamas, for example, were to lay down arms.
So I'd like us to spend a bit of time talking about the current war. And you've alluded to the idea that there was a terrible massacre. I think not everyone is aware of the full details of what had occurred. So if you could elucidate some of that. And then also what you think the different responses that the Israeli state could take and whether their current responses are justifiable.
Right. Well, I think it's widely known now that on the 7th of October, which was the Sabbath in Israel and also a holiday, there was this attack in the early morning where Hamas fighters, through a very clever plan, which they managed to keep secret from the Israeli intelligence services, traversed the border, managed to blank out the communication systems from that area. They then began to attack local kibbutzim and towns, killed people. They also killed people at the music festival that was taking place near the Gaza border. The killings were horrendous. Not all the details are confirmed yet, but we know that people were shot at point blank range, often with their hands bound behind their backs. People were burnt alive. People were killed with grenades. There are stories of decapitation. I've heard at least one eyewitness account of somebody who was probably a foreign worker who had already been shot, being decapitated with a farming instrument, and he was writhing on the floor while this was going on. There have been accounts of babies that were missing their heads, but the Israeli forensic authorities are unsure whether that was done as a way of killing the baby or whether it happened after the baby was killed, or whether it was through some kind of rocket which blew the baby's head off. So those sort of details we don't know, but there was a great barbarity in these killings. I mean, first of all, there was the killings, there was the barbarity in the killings, there were instances of rape as well. There were also instances, at least one of which I know, where one of these Hamas terrorists uses the cell phone of a victim to call back to his parents, tell them that he's killed 10 Jews, and he's a hero, and they need to welcome him accordingly when he returns. So great barbarism that took place. And now, of course, Israel, after that, is faced with the decision as to what does it do. And it immediately mobilized a large number of forces, and the ground invasion was anticipated. It took longer in coming than was anticipated, but it now has begun. Prior to that, of course, there was the aerial bombardment, which also now continues once the ground invasion has taken place. I think a lot of people in the West, and certainly throughout the Arab world and Muslim world, think that this response of the Israelis is unjustified. Now, let me say I'm not an expert in just war theory and in military ethics. This is not an area in which I have expertise, and so there's a limit to how much I can speak about it. But I don't think I need to be an expert in order to make some basic points about this. The first is that it is not a real option for Israel to have not responded to this in an even more forceful way than it has responded to the prior rocket attacks that have been ongoing against Israel. Because if they didn't do that, they would be perceived in that region as being weak, and they would be inviting similar attacks in the future. And so this is a defensive move. It's not defensive against an instantaneous attack, although there's that too, because the rockets are coming up from Gaza. This aerial bombardment is not going in both directions. The Israelis are better at intercepting through the Iron Dome. So it's defensive to that extent. But to the extent that they wanted to rout out Hamas, that is defensive in a prospective sense. It's defensive in the sense of wanting to prevent further such attacks and also to prevent attacks from hostile agents on other borders who might be emboldened if they were to see Israel acting what they would take to be weakly in response to the attack on the 7th of October. Now, just war theorists often speak about the requirements for going into war in a just way. And there are obviously lots of things that you can haggle about here, but there is not a moral equivalence between the attack of Hamas on Israel on the 7th of October and the response back from Israel. I mean, for one thing, we're just dealing with different regimes. We're dealing with an authoritarian regime that is unresponsive to the vox populi, to the voice of the people in Gaza. So whether they wage war or not wage war, they don't have a recent current mandate from their population to do so or to engage in an attack of this kind. Whereas on the other hand, we've got a substantially imperfect, but a substantially liberal democracy that does have the authorization of its population. If you look at the probability of success, I think much greater probability that Israel will attain some of its goals through a military intervention, even if it's not actually routing, it's creating enough of a deterrent to minimize the number of attacks that it receives. Certainly, the pounding of Gaza has in the past brought periods of quiet. And so there's some success from doing that. We look at question of last resort. I don't believe Hamas's attack was a last resort for the reasons that we've already discussed. There can be debates about a just cause. I mean, some people will say the Palestinians have a just cause in attacking Israel here. So then we have to get into the weeds about whether their cause is just or not, even if it's not a last resort, although you need to meet all of these conditions. But what's not just is the establishment of a state with Sharia law. So if what they wanted to do is conquer Israel and establish that, that certainly wouldn't be just cause under this. And then if we look at the jus in bello, the justice in the fighting of a war, there are lots of factors there. Things like military necessity. So to what extent is it militarily necessary? I don't think that it is militarily necessary for Hamas to launch that attack on Israel. There's much greater military necessity on the other side. If we look at fair treatment of prisoners of war, there's definite asymmetry there. The hostages that have been taken into Gaza, not liable to oversight by the International Red Cross, for example, whereas Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons do have such access and are more reliably treated. The distinctions that are made within war, it's sort of indiscriminate when Hamas is firing. It's indiscriminate with respect to Israeli victims. It's indiscriminate even to an extent with regard to Palestinian victims because they're using human shields there. Whereas there are at least some distinctions that are drawn by the Israeli side. Now, are they perfect? Probably not. But the aerial strikes, as I understand it, require legal authorization on a kind of individualized basis. Once you get into the messy work of a ground invasion and decisions are being made in the heat of the moment and the fog of war, it's very likely that there'll be lapses of judgment. A common complaint is that Israel is engaging in a genocide in Gaza. I think this is an inflammatory comment. There's certainly an immense amount of Palestinian civilian collateral damage. And it's deeply distressing. It's deeply tragic. It's heart-wrenching. Not all Israelis are moved by that, but very many of them are moved by that. So those are very real concerns. But the worry, and this is where I come to the most difficult point of proportionality, is that many people think that proportionality requires killing no more of the other side, or at least of civilians of the other side, than have died in the attack to which you were subjected. And that is not what the principle of proportionality means within just war. It's whether the collateral damage is proportionate to the military aims. And that is a much more complicated decision to make. And in fact, it's one that is very hard to judge from afar. You really need to know on a strike-by-strike basis, what was the benefit of this strike and what was the anticipated collateral damage? These are immensely difficult decisions to make, but you can only make them if you have the necessary information. And that's presumably what some kind of judicial inquiry into particular events would do, if it could do it in an impartial way, would be to assess that kind of evidence. And this is again why I'm very suspicious about the people chanting in the public square about a genocide, about the Israelis wanting to eradicate the Gazans. If they wanted to, they could have eliminated them all by now. They have the military equipment to do that. They could flatten Gaza and that would be over. That's what an indiscriminate genocide looks like. That's not what they're trying to do.
So that's a really interesting problem, is this problem of proportionality. It's a problem that's heightened in Gaza because Hamas has a tendency to locate its headquarters and its operating facilities in urban areas, under hospitals, under schools. They fire rockets from residential buildings. That makes it almost impossible to attack those areas without collateral damage and without civilians being harmed. So proportionality becomes incredibly difficult to assess. And I really like your point that it's a highly difficult problem. It's not a simple weighing up of how many people died on one side versus the other, because Israelis are not doing the same. So they're not situating their army under schools or under hospitals. And I think maybe the point that arises out of this discussion, at least of the war, is that there's enormous complexity here, and it seems to be disingenuous, or at least it seems to be overly simplistic to just declare one side is acting disproportionately, or the Israelis are acting disproportionately, given how incredibly sophisticated this problem is.
That's exactly right. I mean, if you look at these two things, if you look at the attack on 7th of October, that is by any measure, obviously wrong, deeply, deeply wrong. If we look at the Israeli response, there's a highly complicated discussion that you have to have in order to work out whether what they're doing is wrong. And they're going to be situations where they get it right, and they're going to be situations where they get it wrong. And so when you see not only no protest against the attack of 7th of October, and in fact, very often a justification of the attack on the 7th of October, and yet in some quarters, you get an outpouring of sentiment demanding that Israel not defend itself, then you've got a moral perversion here. Now, again, I want to emphasize, I'm not underestimating the tragedy that is being suffered by Gazans on the ground. It's absolutely horrific. I can't even begin to say how horrible it is. It's just awful. But you can't on that basis say that what is going on is wrong, because this is the horror of war. This is why we want to avoid war. And very often war can be avoided. Very often an attack is completely unjustified. If you look about the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that is obviously an invasion that should not have taken place. Ukraine was really posing no threat to Russia, even though it wanted to join NATO. I mean, I understand that Russians perceive that as a threat, but that was not a grounds for entering into war. When you are constantly bombarded by rockets from a neighbor, and they launched the kind of attack that they did on the 7th of October, to say that they can't respond to that, that they ought not to respond to that, that they ought not to root out, if they can, the force that is responsible for that, that I think is to apply a standard that nobody else would. I would like to know somebody who says that Israel may not defend itself here, that it ought not to do that, or defend itself effectively. Because if you think, well, just a few bombs can go in, then you've defended yourself, that's gratuitous. If you send a few bombs in and you don't actually achieve the military goals you're trying to do, then that's gratuitous. I want to know, would you do the same thing if you were subject to that kind of assault?
I've heard the position raised that by some progressive politicians in the US that Israel is under an obligation, given the sort of hostage situation that's happening already within Gaza, not the hostage situation of Israelis being taken hostage, but that they compare the situation, the hostage situation, they say what's really happening is that Hamas is taking ordinary Gazans hostage. And so by Israel bombing the area indiscriminately, as they call it, it's not indiscriminate, but by Israel bombing in a way that will inevitably result in civilian casualties, they're effectively bombing hostages, as well as perhaps maybe Israel's hostages that have been stored in that area. So their solution, this progressive solution, is that enormous numbers of Israeli lives should be sacrificed by implementing surgical strikes against Hamas terrorists. So the Israeli army should go in using commando forces. Many Israeli commandos will die this way, but that is their responsibility, to go in and surgically remove Hamas elements without collateral damage.
Well, it's unlikely that even then you'd have no collateral damage. And it's also less likely that they'd be successful without the aerial bombardment. So again, but these are factual questions. I'm giving you a quick kind of response from what seems plausible, but experts in the area who know not only all the sort of ethical issues, but who know the factual issues on the ground, which are just so complicated, would need to evaluate those kinds of claims better. But it's certainly true that Hamas's failure to abide by the rules of war by using human shields doesn't alleviate Israel of its obligation to respect the distinction between civilians and fighters. So Israel does still have that obligation. This is not you don't get a blank check, complete free license to do whatever you want simply because the other side is hiding behind civilians. But Israel, under the rules of war, is entitled to defend itself. And then there are going to be questions that arise about the proportionality of particular strikes. And again, the proportionality is proportionality between not numbers of people who die on either side, but the costs and benefits of the strike. And what is the aim of the strike, and can that amount of anticipated collateral damage be justified given the nature of the target?
So I wonder how much this comes down to a clash in values. So I recently was involved in a debate with Mohammed Hijab, who's a very well-known Islamic apologist, and we aired that episode on Brain of At. He recently engaged in a series of protests in North London, which is a very Jewish area. He said the difference between the Jews and us is that the Jews value life and we value death. We think that life begins after death. And if you think about if Israelis used a strategy of human shields, how that would play out, it would deter Hamas nothing. They would say, oh, you're covering yourselves in more civilians. Well, more civilians for us to kill. The Israelis, on the other hand, take the view that every loss of civilian life is a tragedy, that they will use knock bombs to warn civilians to leave an area so that they can wipe out military targets while avoiding civilian life. It seems that clash in values makes a big difference in terms of how the two sides will operate. What's interesting, of course, is that the public reaction has been not to take into account that there's a clash of values. It's instead to merely look at the number of deaths on either side and assume that there's an equivalence between those things. And that seems, to my mind, improper. That the way the reporting goes is to say X number of people have died on either side. How they died and why they died seems to be an important part of that moral equation. So I wonder what your thoughts are on that. And I also, one of the things that sort of often comes up in these discussions is that people want to draw a distinction between being anti-Zionist and being anti-Semitic. And it seems that distinction has come down a lot of places where protests around the world are not just aimed at Israelis or at Israeli embassies, but they are outside Jewish places. So in South Africa, for example, in Cape Town, the Jewish Museum was a target of protest. That Jewish students at Columbia University are being targeted. that outside the Sydney Opera House, protesters were shouting, fuck the Jews and gas the Jews. None of that is aimed at Israelis. It seems that there's this huge surge in anti-Semitic violence at the moment, and that Jews are seen as legitimate targets because of what's happening in Israel.
Good, thank you. Let me say a few things here. First of all, my understanding is that the Israeli Air Force has now discontinued the roof knock-in with the explosive-free shells. So this is sort of one way in which they've ratcheted up. Their alternative is to ask Gazans to leave the areas where they're going to be concentrating the bombardment. And I know there have been critiques that the bombardment has also gone on in the areas to which they've directed the Palestinians. The Israeli response to that is that most of the bombardment is going to be in the north, so that people are safer in the south. There's a whole lot to haggle about there. But there is a broad asymmetry between the way the IDF is conducting this and the way Hamas is. Now, does that sort of culture of death extend to all Palestinians? That's a completely different question. So even if Hamas has that kind of mentality, you don't know that the civilians is. And so there's a lot of justification for abandoning the rules of war on the part of Israel. Now, you've also raised the question about anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. This is a very big question, and I think there's a lot to say about this. But it is quite clear that every time there's a flare-up in the Middle East between Hamas and Israel, or between the Palestinians and Israel more generally, this is felt by Jews around the world. I don't want to say that all anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, but a lot of it is. And we're seeing that Jews really are under threat. Now, there's an extent to which Muslims are as well. There was that horrific killing of a six-year-old Palestinian boy and the attempted murder of his mother as well in the U.S. by some madman who had read about what was going on and now sought to take it out on an innocent person living in the United States. This is one of the deeply abhorrent features of humanity, is that people engage in stereotyping. They will act in violent and indiscriminate ways, or let me put it in violent, indiscriminate ways. And it's horrific when the victims are Muslim, when they're Jewish, when they're Christian, whatever the case may be. If they're atheists, they've been atheist victims as well of violence. So this is horrific wherever it goes. But it does seem to me, and I stand to be corrected if the evidence can be provided otherwise, that the levels of anti-Semitism have surged to much greater extent than the level of anti-Muslim violence and threats and protests around the world. Now, it's different in Israel, because in Israel, the Jews are a majority and they have power there. And there have been rampages by some people against Arabs in the West Bank. And this is completely inexcusable. And I'm deeply disappointed that the Israeli state has not done more now and historically to rein those people in. You know my views on people's requirement to adhere to law in liberal democratic states. You don't take the law into your own hands. If there are people who are engaged in terror, that's left to the authorities to do in a judicious manner, to make the determinations in a judicious manner subject to the rule of law and to take appropriate action. It's not for civilians to go in and attack somebody who bears some superficial resemblance to the people with whom you have a grievance. And sadly, we're seeing that on a large scale around the world. Ironically, what this does is actually strengthen the case for a Jewish state. So the actions of the people who are using the actions of Israel to justify anti-Semitic behavior are actually driving home the message of how important it is that there be a state somewhere in the world where Jews can be defended by themselves.
Well, David, I want to thank you for an absolutely remarkable discussion. I think that this has been weighing on many people's hearts for a long time since the massacre. And your ability to speak about it with such insight and such calmness, and to be able to understand and empathize with both sides, is really to be commended.